Wisconsin has been a hot spot when it comes to Lyme disease, and the problem is likely to get worse over time. In part because of climate change, some species of disease-carrying ticks are able to survive winters that would have killed them in years past, so the ticks are able to move into new areas. And with the ticks comes not just Lyme disease, but other illnesses that can affect humans. Mary Beth Pfeiffer has been an investigative reporter for over 30 years. She's been researching ticks and Lyme disease since 2012. Her new book, out tomorrow, is called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, you didn't start out as a tick and Lyme disease reporter. Talk us through what got you into following this so closely.
Well, I was an investigative reporter. I looked into many issues over the years and did many in-depth reports. And having lived in the Hudson Valley of New York, Lyme disease was always something that I was aware of. It was sort of on my working list as an investigative reporter. But it took me a while to get to it because I didn't really realize how controversial and, frankly, serious a disease this is. So I intended in 2012 basically to write maybe one or two investigative stories about the trend and about whether authorities were doing enough really to control the spread, to alert people about ways they could prevent the disease. But I found a boatload, if you will, of problems associated with Lyme disease, the chief being that people remained ill after being diagnosed and after being treated, and they could not get care for those very serious illnesses.
We'll dig into that in a bit. I want to look at the spread of Lyme disease for a moment first. You write that, and this has been going on here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, the ticks that carry Lyme disease and other diseases are moving into and surviving in new areas, and the disease itself is spreading along with them. Can you talk about the spread of Lyme?
It's quite amazing how this disease and how these ticks, moreover, are moving literally around the planet. They are climbing latitudes in Scandinavia, in Russia, in China. Canada today is at the precipice of a Lyme epidemic, similar to what we have seen blossom in the Midwest and in the Northeast and in other places in the U.S. in the last 30 years. Along with ticks moving further north, what you also have in Canada is the white-footed mouse moving further north. What we're seeing basically in the scientific literature is this correlation between warmer temperatures and places where ticks once could not survive. You know, they were dropped for many years, thousands of years there by migrating birds. But now, when they are dropped there, they are finding places that are very hospitable for them to live and, moreover, to breed.
And are we seeing the incidence of Lyme disease among ticks go up? That is, in addition to the tick population itself going up, the percentage of ticks that can carry this disease is going up.
Yes, you do see that over time. That in New York, for example, at one time we had in the Hudson Valley maybe 3 or 4% of the ticks carried the organism that causes Lyme disease, the so-called Borrelia burgdorferi spirochete, which is a little curly-shaped single-celled pathogen. Now we're up to about 30% of ticks here that are infected with Lyme disease. And as you said in the introduction, they are also carrying other pathogens as well that we need to know about and guard against. And I would also add that areas of Wisconsin are every bit as rife with Lyme disease and these other tick-borne diseases as perhaps anywhere in the world. I, as part of my research, got a hold of about 20 years worth of county-specific data on tick-borne disease, on Lyme disease. So I ranked all 3,000 counties in the United States. And for the last five-year period, from 2002 to 2006, the top 25 counties, 13 of those top 25 were in Wisconsin. That's really quite amazing. No other state had that many you know, high county areas as Wisconsin.
Talking to Mary Beth Pfeiffer, who, her new book is Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. And Mary Beth, you write that there's another environmental factor here. In addition to climate change allowing ticks to spread into new areas, we humans in the United States and elsewhere like to live, you know, on the border of nature, or what we consider a natural area, a forest, a grassland, something like that. But those grasslands and forests have changed. There are more deers, you write, more mice, fewer predators that eat them. It's kind of a perfect storm to brew up a bunch of ticks right on the edge of where we live.
Right. We live in an adulterated world. We live amid these lovely, what we call forest fragments, that aren't quite in the natural state that they once were. So we don't have as many foxes, for example, foxes that would eat those mice that carry the Lyme disease bug and that infect the ticks. It's all part of a cycle of nature. And what we have done is enabled this tick by virtue of, you know, the fossil fuels that we burn and the ways in which we use energy in our society, but also very much in the way we live. We like to live near nature. We like to admire nature. We love when we see deer prancing through a field. But that combination of us living very close to nature and to an adulterated nature puts us on this path for, you know, a certain kind of disastrous disease epidemic. We are you know, living toe-to-toe with ticks that are infected with things that are very harmful to human beings.
Now let's get into Lyme disease itself, and we'll get into some of the controversy there. But I think one thing that a lot of people agree with, whatever their views on chronic Lyme disease is we could use a better test. The tests we have don't necessarily always detect Lyme disease when it's there, right?
Exactly. The only approved test to diagnose Lyme disease, approved that is by the CDC and the FDA, was approved in 1994. And we have known for many years that it fails at various stages of the disease. In particular, at the beginning of the disease, in the early weeks, perhaps 70% of people will wrongly test negative. In other words, they have the disease, but they won't test positive. And, you know, at that stage of the disease, they have the CDC officials basically defend the test by saying, well, you'll get that signature Lyme disease rash at that point in the disease. But only perhaps 70%, best case, will get that rash. But the rash also isn't often seen. It often looks like something else. It might look like hives or a spider bite. So it's not accepted or recognized for the signal indication of Lyme disease. Okay, then you get a few more weeks into the disease. The test performs somewhat better, but it still misses perhaps 30 or 40% of cases. Then you go on, and perhaps a couple of months or 3 or 4 or 5 months into the disease, you're at the point where the test perhaps tells you 95 to 100% of cases with accuracy, okay? But what the foundation, the guiding principle of this test has been wait. Wait a little while, and our numbers get better, and more people will test positive. But that is not something you want to do with this disease. You do not want to let it fester or progress or travel throughout the body. It's not smart, and it's not safe, because Lyme disease spirochetes are very clever organisms. They find places to hide that antibiotic drugs won't reach. They hide to cause havoc in the human body on another day. So there's very little doubt that we need another test. We need a better test. And it's really to the shame of the medical mainstream authorities in this country that this test has been defended for as long as it has, because it has failed to diagnose multitudes of people who have gotten sicker over time.
A lot of people in the medical community are worried, and you write about this, about overdiagnosis and unnecessary treatment, usually with antibiotics. Your reading of this is, no, we have underdiagnosis, not enough people being treated.
Well, the problem when you overdiagnose or falsely diagnose someone with Lyme disease is perhaps you give them 30 days of one of the safest drugs there are on the market, and that is an antibiotic called doxycycline or maybe amoxicillin. On the other side, if you underdiagnose, if you miss diagnosing someone with Lyme disease, you may cause a debilitating disease that may last months, years, or even a lifetime. The Lyme disease spirochete gets into the heart. It can cause Lyme carditis. It can cause neurological problems, meningitis, facial palsy, problems with walking, seizures. Many other things have been associated with this disease. So it's something you don't want to miss. And I make the point in my book that mainstream medicine has very much overemphasized the problem of falsely diagnosing Lyme disease at the expense of correctly diagnosing it. In my research, I found 30 papers in the scientific literature which sort of harped on this idea that we are overdiagnosing Lyme disease. And they were sort of, the charge was sort of led by the first couple of papers, and that they were picked up by other researchers who did what I would call a lot of copycat science. So you have 30 papers on overdiagnosis. I could find 5 on underdiagnosis for a disease that, once it gets out of control, is very difficult to get back under control.
We're talking to Mary Beth Pfeiffer about her new book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I know there's probably snow covering the ground where you are, but have you been seeing more ticks on the ground, on you, on your pets, where you live, where you vacation in recent years? Have you had an experience with Lyme disease yourself? Do you have a question about ticks, Lyme disease, and the other diseases they carry? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to investigative reporter Mary Beth Pfeiffer about her new book out tomorrow called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences with ticks and Lyme disease. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to our callers now. We have Greg with us in Milwaukee. Greg, hi.
Would you please discuss the Powassan virus?
The Powassan virus, that's another one of these tick-borne illnesses, Mary Beth?
Yes, and Powassan is up and coming, I would say. We certainly have it here in New York, and I believe there have been cases in the Midwest as well. It's a very, very serious virus in terms of causing death in 10% of cases. And it also causes very serious neurological issues. There are people who have to go through some sort of, you know, therapy, physical therapy for months after they get this virus. It's just really a terrible thing. Luckily it is in a very small percentage of ticks right now, something on the order of 1% in New York. But again, I suppose we were at that point with Lyme disease many years ago when there were a small percentage of pathogens of all types in ticks, and now there are many more ticks, and there are a growing list of diseases they can give us. So Powassan is something to watch out for, and it is another reason why we really have to protect ourselves against ticks.
Greg, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Diane with us in Madison. Diane, hi.
Hello. I want to congratulate Mary Pfeiffer for her book. I was going to order it, but I wondered if she had it on audio.
I don't believe it's on audio yet. It is in an e-book, though.
And Diane, do you have experience with this yourself?
Yeah, I've had it since 1989, but I didn't get diagnosed till 2014. So I live in Wisconsin, and they don't really treat it here very well. I've run the whole gamut of misdiagnosis, and well, frankly, I almost died several times, and so
Right. Well, Diane, when you say they don't treat it very well in Wisconsin, that statement could be made for very many other states and, indeed, other countries around the world. I went to England, I went to the Netherlands, to France, to Belgium. I spoke to people in Australia and other countries around the world. And basically, the guidelines for Lyme disease care were, as you probably know, written by the Infectious Diseases Society of America. And because they have been endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control, and because the tests and the studies on which they are based have been published in major American medical journals, these guidelines rule how Lyme disease is regarded and treated around the world. And basically, as I maintain in the book, Lyme disease has been minimized. It has been very much framed as a disease that we can easily diagnose with the approved test and that is responsive to, you know, little more than 10 to 28 days of antibiotics. And new research is really questioning both of those assertions, and especially in recent years, the assertion that a short course of antibiotics can eradicate the Lyme bug. Very new research out of major universities is showing that this bug survives these short courses. We basically have to rethink how we treat, how we regard Lyme disease. It is not easy to diagnose, and it is certainly not easy, at least in a good proportion of cases, to eradicate.
Diane, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mary Beth Pfeiffer is with us talking about her new book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. We'll go now to Andrea in Oconomowoc. Andrea, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up that I know, at least I was told about a urine test, and that's how I found out that I have Lyme, and I was told that it's more accurate than the blood test.
Andrea, thanks. A urine test as opposed to a blood test, Mary Beth.
Well, you know, there's a lot of alternative tests out there that Lyme specialists access when they come up against, you know, late-stage Lyme disease, especially cases that have basically been rejected by primary care and other doctors. So you have people going through the mill, you know, 5, 10, sometimes 20 doctors before they finally get someone to diagnose them and treat them for late-stage Lyme disease. And the problem with the existing test is that it doesn't tell whether you are currently infected or whether you are showing antibodies from a past infection. So we really don't know with good certainty who is or is not suffering from Lyme disease. So people often will access these other tests that are out there, urine tests, other better antibody tests, tests sometimes that can culture the Lyme disease spirochete. There are people working on that very thing. But, you know, I can't endorse any specific test or say it works better than any of the alternatives that are out there. What I can say is that the test we have is greatly flawed, and people are very much searching for an answer to this, and they often turn to this menu of alternative tests that are out there and being marketed.
Andrea, thanks, and good luck as you're dealing with that health concern. We'll go next to Dylan with us in Green Bay. Dylan, hi.
Hi. So I'd just like to tell a brief story about this little hidden hilltop in the Nicolet National Forest where herons go to nest in the spring. And I went there dozens of times as a kid and wandered all around the woods, never had a tick. Last summer, I took my girlfriend up there to show her, and we went on a hike. Came back, I insisted we do a tick check, and we had no less than 20 up between the two of us. So I just want to comment that I really, really agree with the premise that they are spreading like wildfire.
Dylan, thanks a lot for that call. And Mary Beth, as we start to wrap up, I wanted to get into, are there things we can do to either stop the spread of these ticks or stop the ticks from spreading onto us?
There's very little we can do to stop the spread of the ticks. Basically, our alternative, our solutions as people who like to enjoy nature is to protect ourselves and especially protect children. Children from 5 to 9 years old are the most frequently bitten, and other ages of children are, you know, follow close suit. So we really want to protect our kids. One thing that I found to be extremely effective, and I did some research on it for my book, it's in the last chapter, is permethrin-soaked clothing. A guy at the University of Rhode Island by the name of Tom Mather did a study of shoes and socks that were basically sprayed with this substance, which is derived from chrysanthemum flowers. It's not like DEET where you, you know, or OFF where you use it on in a single spray. You actually soak the shoes, you soak your socks, and you can wear them many times and be protected from ticks. And Mather found that people who had just this simple shoe and sock combination going on were 74 times less likely to be bitten than people who didn't have this protection. It also can be applied to pants that you use when you frequently hike. People who work outdoors really should be required under law. Their employers ought to be required to provide permethrin-soaked clothing, and that is, in fact, what employers in the Netherlands have to do.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's been an investigative reporter for over 30 years. She's been researching ticks and Lyme disease since 2012. We've been talking about her new book. It's out tomorrow. It's called Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Still time to tweet us your tick story if you're seeing lots of them in your area when the snow goes away. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.